Into Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. It is Wednesday, August 11th, and it's 11 a.m. on CKUT. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. We broadcast every Wednesday at 11. Thank you for being with us. On the broadcast today, I'm going to be speaking with an activist at McGill University, Alexia Wildhaber Riley, who's an activist with Divest McGill. That's a group that is exploring the various links between McGill investments and corporate injustice. Particularly, the group has been focusing on the relationship between McGill University and TC Energy. That is the main company that invests in the Coastal GasLink pipeline, which is being constructed on Wet'suwet'en Nation territory. That is the Indigenous nation that has been protesting the TC Energy pipeline on their lands. This is a pipeline that is not supported by the collective of the community, the Indigenous people whose territories are going to be directly impacted by the pipeline. We talk about that, but also the broader sort of critique of corporate investments on the part of universities and why also understanding the relationship between climate justice and a support for Indigenous sovereignty is critical within the context of colonial Canada. So here's our conversation, and I'll just share that here on Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm joined by Alexia Wildhaber Riley, who's one of the activists at McGill that has been really trying to challenge and critique McGill University's investments in a number of corporations that are directly tied to destructive environmental practices. The group is Divest McGill, but Alexia and others have been particularly working on trying to highlight McGill University's connection to TC Energy, which is the company building the Coastal GasLink pipeline, which is being constructed on Wet'suwet'en territory without their consent, without the collective support of the Indigenous people affected. So I thought it was important to speak with you, Alexia, about this campaign, and also just, you know, as we are looking towards the next year, you know, conditions seem to be changing a bit about life on campus, and I'm sure there'll be some action and activism around this issue. So thanks for talking. Hi, first of all.
Hi, Stefan. Hey. Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, thank you. So yeah, just can you just for somebody who's just watching this or listening to this now, can you explain why and how is McGill involved in the pipeline being built on the lands of the Wet'suwet'en?
Okay, perfect. So to begin, McGill being a university, like most universities, has an endowment fund that they manage. So that's a big amount of money. For McGill, it's around, I think, a billion or a bit more of funds that they manage, that they invest in. And in terms of the TC Energy pipeline, so the Coastal GasLink pipeline, McGill has roughly $4.7 million invested in that pipeline. So that's like McGill's direct tie. Mm-hmm.
And so when, just for somebody who maybe doesn't understand, what is an endowment?
Okay, so an endowment is that's the fund that the university has and that they manage to maintain the university's functioning, to finance its expansions, its courses. It's basically the university's, like, the extra profit that they have, they'll invest it in different things to make sure that it can survive over the years. And so that endowment fund comes from many things. Like, obviously, some part of it is from tuition, but the rest of it is a lot from big donations and then any types of research that the university does that the university receives funding from. But yeah, in terms of the endowment, how it works and all that. I gotta say that I'm not fully versed on that. But I just know that all universities definitely have an endowment fund.
Yeah.
And they really vary in size, depending on the size of the university
too. And through that endowment, they invest in parts of different companies, corporations. Yeah.
Exactly.
Including TC Energy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. So they'll have shares like in the stock market in these different companies. In the stock market, obviously, they also have shares in probably like safer investments that are, but they have shares in these companies. Mm-hmm.
So can you explain for us a bit about Divest McGill and why you've been trying to address the issue of McGill's investments in relation to climate justice, in relation to Wet'suwet'en, and more generally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So just to like provide some context, so I'm a white settler activist working with Divest McGill for roughly like a year and a half now. And I'm doing an environmental degree at McGill, finishing 2 years out of three. And so basically to answer the start of the question, it's like through conversations and a lot of like research I've done and conferences and meeting people, I've really come to understand that climate justice is a framework to which to address the climate crisis that takes into account human nature and non-human nature. And I say human nature, non-human nature, because it's like the easiest way to understand this, because the Western binary that most of us have grown up in really classifies those two things as distinct. But what climate justice tries to do is like put them back how they actually should be, to create this new conception of the environment and this new conception of nature. Well, not really new, but more tying into what really it is. And so, climate justice really sees that, you know, the oppression of nature and the oppression of people are very much linked, and they're mainly linked through settler colonial capitalism, through like cis hetero patriarchy, through racism and white supremacy, like to name a few of them basically. And so those in terms of like in Canada, or in so-called Canada, as I should say, settler colonial capitalism is really what is driving the climate crisis and is also what is driving the violation of Indigenous rights. So then to get into McGill's involvement in that. So there's several parts to that answer. Mm-hmm. So the first part of it is to understand, and like that's the most important part, is that it's basically by McGill investing in TC Energy, McGill is investing in the violation of Indigenous sovereignty. As you said in the intro, the Wet'suwet'en Nation, their system of governance, which are the hereditary chiefs, not the band council, have always said no to the Coastal GasLink pipeline. So the fact that it's still being constructed on their unceded territory, the Wet'suwet'en Nation never signed treaties or any type of agreement with the Canadian Crown, giving away their rights and title. So like the nation still has rights and title on their territory. So by that pipeline still being constructed, it is a direct violation of a nation's sovereignty. The nation has like several reasons of wanting the pipeline not being in their territory. And like as an outsider and as a non-Indigenous outsider on top of that, like that's, you know, really none of my business. That's the goal of Indigenous sovereignties, is like the nation itself decides what they want to do with their territory and their land. But a lot of the reasons that they do share with outsiders are, you know, it's to protect their waterways, it's to protect their flora and their fauna. And so like those are environmental reasons. But the baseline should still be Indigenous sovereignty. You know, if the nation says no, the nation says no, and that's how it is. And so by McGill investing in TC Energy, it's mm-hmm. basically saying, hey, doesn't matter. You know, we're gonna still keep failing this pipeline. We're gonna still keep violating Indigenous rights and Indigenous sovereignty. And McGill also does, by doing that, it also gives a social license to operate. And that's a term that you hear a lot in investment strategies, is that, and it basically refers to the fact by investing in a specific company, you are making it morally acceptable and socially acceptable for this company to keep operating.
Yeah.
And so in the case of divestment, by investing in fossil fuel companies, the message that the university is sending is that we want to keep the status quo going. We want to keep this extractive and environmentally destructive status quo going.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you know, and like, it's McGill, we're not speaking of like your father's investment in the stock market. We're speaking of like one of Canada's top universities that's saying, not only are we investing in something that's like creating climate crisis in terms of just greenhouse gases, but we're also investing in something that is like maintaining a settler colonial status quo.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the gist of it.
And I think that, you know, the interesting contradiction, and I mean, you're a student at McGill, so I'm sure that you've witnessed this the last few years. There is a lot of discussion around McGill's reckoning with its own history in regards to the links of James McGill to slavery. In fact, that he enslaved people and profited off of enslavement and the system of slavery. And there's been, in response to that, quite a significant motion on, at least in relation to public discourse from the university, to speak to, you know, various issues when it comes to Black Lives Matter, when it comes to acknowledging histories of oppression and slavery, but also when it comes to the climate crisis, when it comes to Indigenous peoples and communities, nations, calls for justice. You know, we see things like McGill inviting Indigenous elders. We see things like a land recognition being part of their discourse. I'm just wondering if you could talk a bit about this moment we're in, because, you know, as a student, because we're seeing a shift in discourse. And I think, you know, all that we were just talking about around the investment through endowments of the university speaks to that space of contradiction between the discourse that has changed in some ways at this moment and the actual sort of infrastructure of colonialism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the first thing that I heard a lot in what you were saying was hypocrisy. And I think that's the main thing that you realize when you're a student that goes to McGill, is you're sold this image of a university that speaks of reconciliation, that speaks mm-hmm. of wanting to, you know, advance the cause for the Black community, that speaks of sustainability. And then you get to the university and you get into the space and you realize it's all just a facade. And everything that they do, from land acknowledgements to their initiatives, for the most part, it's not attacking the core root of the problem. And so to begin with, you know, the fact that they're inviting in Indigenous speakers, but they're profiting off the violation of Indigenous rights, you know, it's so frustrating, because it's just clearly just so hypocritical. And, you know, and then they do land acknowledgements, but there's no plans of actually respecting Indigenous sovereignty once again. And, you know, I was told by a fellow Indigenous activist, Lucy, that like making a land acknowledgement is useless unless you are actually going to work towards giving the land back. And McGill is not ready for that reckoning yet. And one of the main reasons why it's not ready for that reckoning is because it's not a democratic institution. You know, it doesn't it's very much a top-down approach. And so you have these students, you have these activists that are bringing the new discourse, as you're saying, that are bringing it forward, and that are speaking of, you know, Indigenous sovereignty and Black Lives mm-hmm. Matter and like true actual climate, like justice-oriented solutions. And we have all this push and this energy and these ideas, but because it's hierarchical, we can't actually shift the university in the ways that we want it to. Mm-hmm. And so the discourse is definitely there, but the power imbalance is also there. And so that's something that needs to be addressed. Because in context of, just to provide a bit more context to what I say for that, McGill's governance system has like two top tiers. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the McGill Senate, and that is a democratic body. So we have students on it, we have teachers, we have staff, we have administrative staff, and the likes. And that body has voted for divestment. You know, they have voted in 2018, they've passed a motion for McGill to divest from the fossil fuel industry. But on top of that, the last governing body that have the veto right on McGill's investments, that's the Board of Governors. And the Board of Governors is not democratic whatsoever. it's composed of people that are chosen usually for their ties in industry. And so, for example, on that board, there's this one lady, and her name, I'm missing it right now, but she worked for 19 years for Petro-Canada. So, you know, we're speaking of people that have ties in the big places and that are clearly making choices because, you know, they have those ties in the industry and they just want to keep it going. So in terms of while the discourse is there, and it's beautiful that it is there, we have to like think more critically of how we're going to like to concretely advance for divestment, and to concretely advance not just for divestment, but also for Black Lives Matter and for Indigenous sovereignty. We need to have that power shift within the university.
Thanks for sharing all that. So one, you know, the group that you're involved in, Divest McGill, has been addressing these various issues within different contexts. You know, obviously, the climate crisis was a focus of many people's attention pre-pandemic. There was huge demonstrations around the world. There was Fridays for Future movement. And in some ways, the pandemic has illustrated sort of the crisis of ecology in the sense of awakening people to the interconnection and collectivity of humanity. But it did also dampen the capacity of people to mobilize on the streets. So I'm just wondering, you know, looking forward to the next year, I know that you've been involved in a lot of activism around climate justice on campus. What are some of the issues that you're hoping to raise, and why is it important for student activists and also, you know, from your perspective more generally, to keep a focus on climate justice in relation to that broader systemic analysis that you've been highlighting that speaks to climate justice within the context of understanding the climate crisis as being perpetuated by settler capitalist colonial systems?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's going to be, I'm very hopeful about what's going to be to come. But at the same time, and we spoke about this before, Stefan, there is that kind of frustration that a lot of the momentum that was there specifically for the Wet'suwet'en Nation pre-pandemic has really kind of sizzled out, I feel, in like popular consciousness and media. So that definitely needs to be brought back to the forefront. And I think, unfortunately, but with the recent discoveries of the mass graves in the residential schools, like just the pure atrocity of that, I just hope that people like that settlers in Canada and non-Indigenous people in Canada can no longer be blind to Canada's colonial present. And so it's really that I think is going to be like my focus and my hope for what's coming, is that there's really going to be that reckoning and that realization that no, like Canada is a settler colonial state. You know, this is ongoing and this needs to be changed. And by, as a student activist, my role in that is to illustrate the closest examples to me of settler colonialism. And so in that case, it's really McGill's involvement. You know, that's like the most direct example of something that I can actually concretely work on. So I think there's definitely that. I think also that the pandemic has brought up the many failures of capitalism and the many failures of neoliberalism. In terms of, you know, like our weakened social safety net, you know, how people were like just not being taken care of by the state. If the state should be the one taking care of that, that's a whole other discussion. You know, I'm more for something more on the ground level, a bit more like localized, less of a state power and more kind of like a local system of governance and of systems of aid. But that's another discussion. But I think most people in the pandemic have realized like, A, society will not look out for myself unless I consciously work for that. Mm-hmm. And B, you know, like this system is not serving us, basically. This broad system is not serving us. And so everybody has been a bit affected, be it through losing their job, be it through seeing the healthcare system not be able to take care of their loved ones. And not because it's not a working healthcare system, it's because it's been seriously underfunded for years and years and years because of neoliberal strategies, or just, you know, losing their homes because rent evictions and stuff like that. So I think there's a lot of people are clicking in, you know, people are clicking in that, like, if you don't look out for yourself and people that you love and people that are in similar situations than you are, you can get into very precarious situations very fast, because in the end, you know, most of our society is still looking forward to make that profit and that scent off of all of us. So I think that there's a lot, and I hope, so I think there's that. And I think a lot of people are also open to solidarity work. And that's of vital importance in terms of land back, because, you know, the Indigenous population in Canada, in so-called Canada, I think is like 5% of the population or something like that. It's like super, super low. Correct me later if that's a wrong stat, I apologize. So, you know, we're speaking of 95% of like settlers that need to come to terms that Indigenous sovereignty and Indigenous land back means giving up your privilege and your possession of territory of land. And so that has to come from a deep place of solidarity, but also a deep place of understanding that it is also just morally right and the key to ending our settler colonial state. So I don't know if that really answers your question.
And on that point, you know, I mean, you've made that link between these points of analysis and the climate, right? And I think often they're separated. So maybe we can just end on that connection and why that's important.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Yeah, definitely. So why the climate crisis and Indigenous sovereignty are more linked to that kind of way you want to address. So what I've read up and what I've learned and what I've been told, it really falls into two main categories, I guess. On the first side, all around the world, it is Indigenous peoples in different nation states that are protecting the most biodiversity off the get-go. They're the ones that have, like, these many nations, these many peoples have different ways of interacting and relating with nature that are outside the Western conception of nature and are obviously proper and different and distinct to every single Indigenous peoples. But they have ways of relating with nature that are not based on our extractivist status quo. So they have ways of working with nature that do not fuel the climate crisis, basically, that being said. And then in terms of Canada, Canada's wealth is built on extraction. You know, we are an extractivist state. You know, our wealth comes from our wood, our minerals, our fossil fuels, you know, all that. That's how Canada became an economic powerhouse. And to do so, to be able to extract these resources, which are the main resources causing the climate crisis in terms of fossil fuels, we had to alienate indigenous peoples from their territories. So we had to eradicate them from their territories. And so that is basically the main link, is to understand that for Canada to keep functioning economically, and because we have a fossil fuel-based economy, we have to violate Indigenous sovereignty. And so that really is the main link. And then once you understand that, you can also then understand the nuances of the link, which comes to terms of violence against Indigenous women, girls, Two-Spirit, and LGBTQIA+ people. Because these pipelines, as they're being constructed all over the territory, they're being constructed in areas where there's not a lot of manpower. So they need to bring in foreign workers. And when I mean foreign workers, I just mean foreign to the locality itself. And so these foreign workers come in and they create what are called either worker camps or man camps. And so these camps are just a group of people that are there working that do not have ties to the usually neighboring Indigenous communities, because we're speaking of pipelines. Like, pipelines don't pass next to Montreal. You know, they pass next to reserves. They pass next to places where there's not enough pushback by the community, because the communities don't have enough actual power to say, no, we don't want a pipeline here, as we can clearly see with the Wet'suwet'en Nation. So anyways, coming back to the point. So these camps are constructed next to Indigenous communities and are filled with people that have high disposable income and that are not staying in the community for long. And so there have been documented, and this is very much a fact, that was found in numerous papers, but mainly the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. That there's this is a fact that these man camps linked to pipelines and linked to extraction industries are directly linked and correlated to an increase of violence against Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people. And so that is also like the other link within the climate crisis, is that it's not only a violence against the planet as its whole, but it's also clear violences against like people's bodies. So I think, I hope that ties it in there.
Yeah, thanks for sharing all this, Alexia. And Divest McGill's website is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's divestmcgill.ca. You can join that. And if anybody is interested in joining the group, definitely send us messages too on Facebook or on Instagram.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Stefan.
That was a conversation with an activist and student at McGill University, Alexia Wildhaber Riley, who works with the group Divest McGill. As you heard, they have been campaigning against McGill's investment in companies that are linked to climate injustice and the ongoing violations of Indigenous peoples' territorial and human rights through construction of pipelines for oil and gas industries. This is the case, of course, with TC Energy that is building the Coastal GasLink pipeline on the Wet'suwet'en Nation's land. That is without their collective agreement. So that's very important for us to consider and to recognize that McGill is involved in this process. And so I'd encourage people to look up Divest McGill for more information. This has been Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. We broadcast every Wednesday on CKUT. You can also find our podcast. Look us up on Apple Podcasts, Free City Radio. We broadcast 11 to 11:30, CKUT.ca, 90.3 FM in Montreal. Thanks to Alexia for joining the show today. And do stay tuned. The F-Files is coming up next. And to go out, I'm going to go to a collaboration between Narsi, Yassin Bey, or Mosdef, and a tribe called Red. I'll talk to you next week. Take care.
Bismillah. Hey. Showing living by the G code. What the fuck is Fleek though? Don't ask them, what do he know? What I forgot is better than whatever they remember. Never mind, I'm off it, it's quiet form. Time to put the temper tantrums to the quiet corner. Hush, that's enough, said the ruler. No suckers allowed to break bread or asunder. The daylight, lightning and the thunder. Sun, moon, the stars and the hunger. Abundance in bundles, blessings in troubles. Towers and tunnels, views and valleys, waves and peaks. Streets you from sun, planet Earth. And ain't scared of no Mars attack. What type of bars is that? Stay off my jack. I'm out there corny riot garments, top five. Dying on and on them, super fly, slick at top, bro. Eagles diving on them. You, why you lying, homie? You won't play with my emotions, Smokey. Big chief, heart rate, big beat, B-E-Y-I, seen straight jacket, come clean. Big said it was a dream, now it's a living thing. With you and living kings, I mean it, I mean. I mean, straight jacket, come clean, y'all seen, in the R.E.P. Original nation, we burn solid, we're with you and living, you know, with you and living. Emergency on planet Earth. The currency is murder, you a man of worth. They say the day is coming, drumming that you can't reverse. Watch the banner burn. before the cannon burst. Don't chase an illusion, the nation hallucin. Hallelujah, taste of the future. The people that shower, the piss of the coward, they're facing the future. Lonely martyrs, magic carpets, dirty blankets, Coca-Cola, soul controller, holy waters. Middle East mode, sand glorious, cheat code in Babylonian, the Orient. My superhero got the people power. Yasin and Yasin, you should heed the hour. With you and living kings, I mean it.
What made you drop out?
Well, a lot of people think it was a 400 acid trip they took, you know.
Uh-huh, but what was it really, Bob?
One day I played CKUT in 90.3.
Then what happened?
I saw God.
You I saw God. That. Well, that sounds like true enlightenment to me,
yeah,
Bob.
Yeah, we grim.
And on the seventh day, the Lord said,
let there be a CKUT.
F-Files Radio.
Exploring feminism and technology through space and time.
Good morning, you're listening to XX Files Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM or online at ckut.ca. I'm your host, Bara, and on this full moon, I'm going to be talking about the connection